Greetings and thanks for coming. This is a thought number one for the evening. This is from the novel 1984. Everybody hear me in the back? Is any problem, any issues there? We're good? Thanks. So it's a little bit about the 1984. If you know the book, well, the guy's job is to sort of rewrite the past according to the government's present policies and plans. And so we'll get into a little bit more of that. Second thought, just before we begin, you can imagine if you live in a country where you think they're not telling you the truth, this may keep you up at night. So the presentation is called Greets from Room 101. I'm Kenneth Gears, and probably suffices for an intro. So in the book, right, I would say that there's a government information warfare against its own people. And there's a lot of use of technology. It's very interesting to consider in light of the Internet. They use two-way telescreens, so in each apartment, each home, the government can see you, and you can see a representative of the government all the time. Room 101 is where you go if you get too clever, if you know, you start questioning things too much, or you get a little bit too smart. Let's look at a quick clip of how this was envisioned in 1949 when Orwell wrote the book 1984. Starts with an alarm clock.
Group, take your places, please. Right. Let's see which one of us can touch his toes. Right over from the hips, brothers and sisters, please. One, two. One, two. One, two. One, two. Smith? 6079 Smith W. Yes, you. Bend lower. You're not trying. Watch me. There, brother. That's what I want. Anyone under 45 is perfectly capable of touching his toes. I'm 39 and I've had 4 children. We don't all have the privilege of fighting in the front line. Remember our boys on the Malabar front. Just think what they have to put up with.
So he's telling her, hey, look, you know, I agree with you. I'm going to touch my toes. I'll try harder. Let's move on. The year 2007, really, day by day, I think the Internet is getting more and more into our lives. If you compare it with traditional media, the newspaper and the radio and the television, much, much more limited, and actually much, much more easy to control on the part of a government, right? So the Internet all of a sudden changes things because, you know, whereas the government, if it was only in charge of the newspaper, that's really slow. That comes out once a day. The television, pre-programmed, radio, the same, right? So you may only have a few channels in the country, but you have to realize with a computer and an Internet connection, each of you has a printing press and a radio transmitter in your own house. And so this makes it very much different for governments to deal with, especially in really authoritarian ones, right? One of the things, I guess, about the briefing is that the nature of the Internet is very, very unpredictable. It sort of is changing by the day. Second, perhaps part of the thesis is that there is good and evil in life, there's good and evil on the Internet, and it really it's up to all of us to help shape it and help define better paths for us to go down. I mean, some of the things that are going on, if you saw some of the other talks, really in the way soldiers speak, you know, soldiers talk about killing people and breaking things, right? That's their job. The Internet more and more is becoming a weapon. And you can see that when you read about the use of IPv6 and other things, the way the Department of Defense and the government is viewing the Internet. We're going to talk a little bit in this briefing about government repression and criminal pursuit, legitimate and illegitimate. Now, if you were hired by a despot in a bad country, right, to advise him or her on the internet, I think one of the first things you would say is, do not trust it if you bring it in any quantity into the country. If you want to keep control of your information space, you have to take serious precautions. There's some funny things, like in Turkmenistan, that guy started naming the months of the year after members of his family. Right, that's one way to cut down on the information space. In Kyrgyzstan, we see that when they didn't like what the news was playing, actively there would be active DDoSing of news media. Now, one of the things you tell them too is that there's good reasons for censorship, right? I mean, because all of us could probably think of something that we would disallow. But then once you give the government the tools that it needs in order to prosecute crime, in order to collect data, those are very powerful tools. And of course, they can be used not only for criminals, but they can be used for political adversaries. And sometimes the lines get so crossed, you have no idea whether you're really looking at a criminal or a political adversary, perhaps even the prosecutor. Now, another thing is you would say, if you're going to use technology in this country in order to further your reign, to keep control on the people, you'd say, you want to deliver unaltered messages to your people, and you want to deny that right to your adversaries, your political adversaries or would-be overthrowers, and that the internet can help, right, especially state-owned telecoms, make it a lot easier to surveil and manipulate traffic. So that's why you'll see in some of these countries what they're trying to do is really develop some kind of a quasi-state monopoly situation, even if it's a private firm, so that, one, they can have visibility on the traffic, and then, two, there's a lot of money to be made in telecommunications, and they don't want people making long-distance phone calls. They don't want people using VoIP in this day and age because that sort of lowers the amount of money coming into government coffers. So cyber tactics are really, them. Essentially, you can read traffic, you can delete traffic, black hole it, or you can modify it. And as you get into the modification area, then it gets more sophisticated, more clever. But it's very doable, and it's really powerful. And you can collect on anything, really, as the network traffic flows along. Now, when you see certain things, you can call law enforcement, and you can knock on somebody's door. And there's a lot of plausible deniability for governments in this, especially in cyberspace, because you really, it's not something you see, it's not something you feel until, the knock comes at the door. And, in terms of international politics and human rights, just look at Zimbabwe for example. I mean, over the last 15 years, you had one guy who essentially took it from perhaps the best country in Africa to the worst country in Africa. And, basically, nobody is threatening invasion. Nobody is threatening replacing this guy. I mean, you really have to imagine pretty terrible scenarios before, sort of a human rights situation will affect somebody's political tenure. None of us has complete access to the internet, right? So it's all filtered in some form or fashion as it travels. And so you can think in some of these countries about being sort of an Eastern Albanian from Dilbert situation in which you're only going to get a small piece of the internet. And a couple of basic strategies are basically blocking international sites. And then you heavily regulate through taxation, registration, re-registration, and re-registration, and question and answer periods, asking for log files, requiring the ISP to buy software and hardware that it can't afford. All of those are reasons that the government can very easily maintain control over telecommunications space. Go on to the next slide. It's not easy, though. The thing is all of us know, especially if you work in any kind of computer network defense role, that it's very difficult to collect the right traffic, to store it, database it, normalize the data, analyze it, have somebody who can write a decent report and somebody to read it and care about it and act on it. Those are all major variables. And so really all governments are dealing with this. Let's see. And your political adversaries in real life, they're going to be your political adversaries in cyberspace. So once you let the internet into your country, I mean, you can bet that both sophisticated users and hostile network operations targeting you are a certainty. Now, a couple of ways to approach controlling the internet are, one, through a denial of sin. And this is fairly easy because even, you know, a programmer could do this fairly quickly. If you go through the dictionary, there are a lot of words in there marked vulgar. And so each one of those, you could just say, pull that out and deny that type of traffic. Right? So pornography is easier to do than politics. The problem is very quickly when you begin to censor traffic, it's very easy to over-censor traffic. So here's just a couple of examples. But, I mean, if you're in a country like Saudi Arabia, which is really trying to have a moral internet, as they put it, all of a sudden you get to a place where you can't look up information on breast cancer, for instance, because it's not wanting you to look at certain words, right? So it's even possible to poison a web server in that sense if just place information on your adversary's server that you know is going to cause that IP to have trouble getting into the country. With politics, it's much, much more difficult because essentially you're talking about words in context, not words that stand out by themselves as marked in the dictionary as being a problem. But you're talking about words that mean nothing in and of themselves, but when you put them together have a very powerful meaning. Now, the problem is for artificial intelligence is that people can't even really perceive, you know, whether it's constructive criticism sometimes or somebody is really taking a pot shot at you, much less humor, etc. You really need a subject matter expert who's totally familiar in the language, the history, and the culture. And the smaller the circle of power gets, obviously, it's going to have an inverse relationship to your ability to be able to monitor the traffic. So you can imagine in a one-man show type of country like North Korea, there is just no way that you're going to be able to properly sort through political traffic. And so basically, you're going to deny everything. So blacklisting and whitelisting, you know, blacklisting, essentially looking for words, string matching, should be a two-stage system. What people are going to go to is whitelisting, right? Because you can't, it's too hard to do a proper blacklist type situation. And so what you're going to do if you want to have a fairly restricted network space and hang on to power is say, I'm going to give you, you know, a couple of news sites, a couple of weather sites, some sports, just enough porn to keep you happy, and that's it. You're not going to go anywhere else, right? Because I just don't have the time to sort through your requests for traffic. Now, there's the supply side and there's the demand side. So we talked a little about the supply side. The demand side can also be heavily affected, especially in countries where people are afraid of the government. So whether it's physical or virtual intimidation, you can definitely affect the demand side of internet traffic. On the government side, on the hiring side, security personnel, definitely, you're going to have to change your hiring practices, right? Because you know, no longer does the truncheon ping mean what it used to, right? Ping has a whole different connotation these days. And so the people you bring in for security management, they're going to have to know something about the internet in order to police the country. So here's kind of four possible commandments if you were going to allow internet into a really restricted political space. I would say you probably want all accounts officially registered. You know, and you want them to show up with their ID, and you want them to show up at the central telecommunications building that's next to your internal security service, right? And they're going to have to give their name and address and your ID number. Now, all the traffic that comes from that account has to be attributable to that account. Users can't share or sell their connections, and they can't encrypt their connections either. So that's going to cause you big pain in decryption. How do you get this stuff? You know, when governments look at the situation, they have some of the same exact questions to answer as you do for your home network, right? Should I rely on the little icon in the system tray to tell me that I'm safe? Right? Or am I going to have to hire people who are going to have to learn how to write snort rules and learn how to database traffic and examine that traffic and try and tell me if it's causing me a problem? Right? These are huge questions for them to answer. Here's four countries, Myanmar, Belarus, Zimbabwe, and Cuba, who have all bought internet surveillance systems from China. There is a corporate connection to this. Now, the industry, they will come back with a solid response in the face of the privacy advocacy. How can you make this stuff and how can you sell it? They say, look, you know, our products are politically neutral. Just like whips and just like chains, right? You can use them for anything. You can use them to pull a car out of the swamp, or you can use them to tie somebody to the wall. But their products, they say, look, you know, we can't control how somebody's going to use this product. Customization is key because you're talking about selling to foreign countries that have different cultures and languages and backgrounds and laws. And so these companies, they actually have to study and it's really the lucrative targets these companies they don't really want to advertise, but they want to be known for selling Saudi Arabia, for selling China, for selling, you know, the software, right? So that's a big coup for them. That's just like anywhere in business. Here's one from Scandinavia. This is free. You can download it to check it out. And on the website it says, you know, this is for a grammar school, theoretically. But you can, it says, you know, you can go from unobstructive to draconian. And so by IP, for instance, through algorithm matching for stuff that you want to come up with on your own, you feel like somebody may have a covert channel in the traffic and you want to fish it out of the traffic. So you can write a custom script for that. Has whitelist and then stealth mode. So with stealth mode, you click on that and it's going to allow people to go to a bad site, but it's going to alert these law enforcement and security personnel at the same time. So last slide in this section, Chance Fedor, TCPIP, governments have a wide array of tools at their disposal, but I think they're hard to use and they're little understood in most of the countries who are trying to use them. So you can blacklist IPs, but one of the things, once you get down into countries that own their telecommunications, lock, stock, and barrel, you're talking about having the ability to essentially own the dictionary. Now, there's a really interesting part of the book 1984 in which the government is trying to prove that it can do anything with its people, and it's telling Winston that 2 plus 2 equals 5, right? And he's like, 2 plus 2 equals 4. Well, when you own the dictionary, right, when you own your top-level domain, when you own all the DNS servers, you can say 2 plus 2 equals 4, right? You can do things like download Amnesty International's .org website, and you can take off your country-specific information, and you can repost that site within your country. Who's going to stop you doing it, right? So as you get down all the way to the bottom, then developing websites just as bait, right, just to pull people out of the woodwork, your political adversaries. All this is possible in the internet. So I came up with this is part two, a top 10 countries to look at. And I don't have any axes to grind against these countries. I didn't really come up with them. I just looked on some of these main, human rights, freedom of the press sites, and they provide a lot of information to look at, sort of case studies that are readily available. Some of it was just subjective analysis. I kind of had to put a list together. You'll see that some of the countries we'll look at, they're just snapshots, really, are very technologically sophisticated and some are not. But then I kind of had to sort of place them in context as well. So Freedom House, this is an outfit that categorizes, you only fall in one of three categories, free, partially free, and not free. I will tell you that's somewhat crude, but all of the countries we're going to look at in this briefing actually fall into one of those colors. Reporters Without Borders, they rank countries top to bottom on a list of freedom of the press. So as you see, Scandinavia is right there at the top, and Eastern Europe as well. So notice Eastern Europe, this is great. I was there not too long ago, I would highly suggest going to Eastern Europe these days because they are really doing, I think, pretty well these days. They sort of, you know, came out of a long sleep through the Warsaw Pact days and are really trying hard now to develop integrity, I think, in law and in taxation and international affairs. I don't want to bore you with that, but you will see them on the top 10 list. We're going to look at the bottom of the list, and most of the countries we're going to look at are there, but as we go through them, I won't give them away just yet. Yes, I think it was about 40, something like that. I think it was about 40, and that may be Fox News dragging it down, right? I'm just kidding. Number 10, Zimbabwe. Let's see. So in Zimbabwe, had found one post on the internet which said on October 20th, 2006, President Mugabe got together with his version of the CIA, and he said, look, we've got a lot of people in our country who are sending out a lot of bad information about our country. You got to find them. You got to find where they are, and here's some of the things you're going to do. I mean, you got to get in the ISPs. I want you to flush out the journalists. I want you to, if you have to, pose as cafe attendants and surfers. And you may need some computer training first, which, again, we were talking about earlier. I mean, it's ridiculous to think, you know, I mean, this is actually hard stuff. It's not easy to do. So one of their strategies is guarding the gateway. So essentially, they would like to develop a an ability to have visibility on all the traffic, but also all the revenues that come from that quasi-governmental telecommunications firm. Let's see. So they have legal backup for what they're doing, and they're putting the burden on purchasing these hardware and software onto the ISPs, which they're complaining about. So for each country, we'll just look quickly at a defacement of a government site, right? So this happens to be from Command Tribulation, which is a Brazilian Christian evangelical defacement group. But just we'll look at one for each of the countries to provide some diversionary eye candy. Number nine is Iran. One of the things about Iran is phenomenal internet growth. So, again, step back and you think about that from a government perspective. Over the course of 10 years, your country is going from virtually not being connected to the internet to everybody being connected to the internet. So just the changes, mind-boggling, especially from the standpoint of, you know, security and control and all of that. Now, one of the things I saw just reading from sort of the NGO-type reports was that it's really pretty mature network surveillance there, but tends not to be draconian. Basically, they're trying to, they're not messing too much with the demand side, but on the supply side, they said at any given time about a third of websites that they, you know, because they've got a large list of websites that automatically, you know, they'll get in the country and they'll try to go to a wide range of sites and report back how many of them were we able to go to on any given time, and about a third are blocked, especially porn, anonymizers, and politics, and especially if it's in the local language. Blogging is huge. You see a lot of good communication. A lot of communication is critical of the government, even on the part of legislators within the government. One guy, for instance, when he got the blacklist, he was a system administrator. He got the official government blacklist, so he just posted it. He was that angry about it. They, you know, so like I said, blogging is huge. They've even accused the CIA of using blogs to undermine the government. So it's a healthier environment here. Here you see the President Ahmadinejad's own blog, and this is very interesting. He's got a message to the American people. He's got a question about the structure of the UN. He's got letters coming from, you know, at least according to the website, right, from American and Britain. Here's a web defacement, a Turkish defacement group using a Native American theme to deface an Iranian site. Very cool. Number eight, Saudi Arabia, right across the Persian Gulf. So we talked a tiny bit about Saudi Arabia. Searching for the moral internet. They have something called the King Abdulaziz City for Science and Technology. It's a national-level proxy, right? So anything, they've got a lot of ISPs in Saudi Arabia, but everything is supposed to flow through this one site, and it's supposed to eliminate the negative aspects of the internet. Now, if you go to a site, now they use caching, blacklisting, and then it's triage. So it's got some artificial intelligence built in. And if you go to a site that it's never seen before, it'll try to make a determination, obviously based on keyword. But you'll get pop-ups. It'll say that this, in Arabic and English, it'll say that this site is disallowed and your request is being logged by the ISP. Encryption forbidden. ISPs have to conform to Muslim values. But the Saudi officials have said, look, this is really hard. We can't keep up. They're fairly honest about this. One of the things happening in Saudi Arabia is that people are just buying satellite dishes and they're connecting. We'll talk about this a little bit later with just overall strategies to get around censorship, but they're just buying satellites and they're going to foreign ISPs. So that's a problem there. But back to the basic strategy within the government. So it's morality and politics. They've said it's morality. It's not politics. But at least one case, there is this London-based opposition group, MIRA, and the government's really played a long-running cat-and-mouse game with this group. And so it's definitely an example of political blocking. One of the interesting things in the country is they have blacklist removal and addition forms. So if you don't like the results you get in a query, say, look, I'm looking for information. I'm not getting it back. See if you can do something about this. And they say they get about 500 a day. Here's a Pakistani/Saudi defacement of government site. Eritrea. So moving into Africa, less technologically advanced. In fact, they were the last country in Africa online. Now, they had a very healthy in Africa history of warfare, unfortunately, in Eastern Africa, but also clandestine radio sort of between them. And so this is slowly but surely moving on to the Internet. As last online, you can see in 2000, you can imagine how long it would take to download a web page at 500 kilobits coming into the entire country per second. So in East Africa, I've only been in Eastern, Sub-Saharan Africa, but you know they don't have cinemas per se. You get out of the main towns. Of course, they have cinemas in big towns, but everybody would have a. You go into a house and somebody would have a TV and a VCR and charge a nickel or whatever it was, and that was kind of the cinema for the town. So ISPs, a lot of people aren't wealthy enough to afford a computer, but so they're typically walk-in affairs. Unfortunately, they were the last online and really the first offline in Africa since 2001. Human rights have been really going downhill. Actually, just a guy from Eritrea was in my cab driver coming over here from Caesars a little while ago, and he was complaining about this, the human rights situation in Eritrea. I said, you've got to do something about the president. But by 2004, cyber cafes had all been moved to education and research centers. You know, people who in the know in the area said absolutely not. The government basically cited pornography, but basically what was in cyber cafes in the country are they're not supposed to be anymore. Number six, Belarus. This really provides us one of our best case studies. Really interesting. Much technology, level of education, very high in Eastern Europe, former Soviet Union. But this country is really anachronistic in that they still call the security service the KGB. It's the only, I believe, in the former Soviet Union. Still, they don't bother to change it. Very Stalinist there. The presidential administration still runs the newspaper, the radio, the television. And within the KGB, you have this thing called the State Center for Information Security, and they own the top-level domain. They own the DNS servers. And there's been a lot of funny games over the past few years with going to websites in the country. You can see in 2001, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, whenever there was a referendum for the president, presidential election, all this, you saw a lot of stuff happening. Last year in March, a huge cyber showdown in the country, really. They had a presidential elections, and both sides were trying to use the Internet to their advantage. The government actually was trying to put infrastructure out into the country because its supporters were largely older and rural. But they couldn't keep up with the opposition groups because they were younger and urban. But on election day, 37 at least opposition media sites were inaccessible in the country. This is fairly crude, but it's true. And the presidential challenger site was dead. Funny DNS errors were reported subsequently. 1 week after the elections, there were demonstrations in the capital. Riot police came out. There was a bunch of arrests. And again, the Internet inaccessible from the capital. The president won by a large margin. Here is a liberty of expression, specific defacement within the government of Belarus. Number five. The top five, I would say, are even much more hard nuts to crack than the 6 to 10. So number five is Burma. In Burma, it's illegal to have incorrect ideas. The net penetration is minuscule. So those who can connect to the Internet, I mean, it's told up front. No politics, no webmail, no anonymity. And on top of that, no porn. Only state email, you're told that if you go into a cyber cafe, you have to show them your name, address, your ID card. Frequent screenshots are going to be handed over to the government, and you can go to prison for any of the following, including some vague criticism. Resistance, pretty futile. There's been online activism abroad, and you'll see, the odd complaint against Burma. But, basically, business interests, national security politics and all that probably come before most other government policies. So the government, you know, probably not too worried about this. The company that sold the software to the government denied it until an NGO actually found a picture on the web of the prime minister of the country and their own sales director closing the deal. There's a Turkish defacement of a Burmese site. Number four is Cuba. Now, Cuba has a little bit different strategy. Cuba says, you know, basically all technology should be in the hands of the government. It's not for private use. The government's supposed to own all computers. And it's funny, in Cuba, you have very educated populations. They've got good educational system, good health care, nobody connected to the internet. Big problem. So they do have some cyber cafes. But again, if it's going to cost you half your monthly salary to get almost no information back, you can imagine nobody's going to even try. So illegal connections to the internet, 5 years. Counter-revolutionary information, 20. I mean, that's pretty stiff. Now, there was an NGO female in the country last year. She brought up an email client, and she typed the names of a bunch of Cuban dissidents in the email. She tried to send the email. First, she gets a pop-up on her screen that says, this program will close for state security reasons, and then her computer, according to her, crashed on her. There's a cyber black market in the country for hardware because it's so rare, but also for these things called connection codes. So if you're a student or you work in a company that actually is supposed to have some access to the internet, you get a connection code. And these are on sale on the black market. Another Turkish defacement. So number three, China. China is perhaps not the most malicious or most authoritarian in this sense, but it does get the three ranking for having the most sophisticated surveillance. All of these adjectives are used to describe, you can sum it up by saying that they have an army of public and private personnel that are involved in doing this as their regular day jobs. One of the things about China is there's massive legal support for the government, and when you analyze the legal behind it, you can see almost no support for the little guy, right? The small people in the country. It just doesn't really exist. Perhaps it's a cultural thing, perhaps it's whatever the reason is, perhaps in the future they're going to need to address legislation that actually refers to, you know, the rights of regular people. So the Great Firewall, we've all heard about that, but if you're in China and you do searches for things like Taiwan, Tibet, Tiananmen Square, you're liable not to get anything back or get very limited returns back. It appears just through testing that this has done a keyword of the National Gateway, but there's sophisticated in China. So it's not just wholesale blocking. You'll even see missing web pages within websites where the content is seemingly consistent through the website. So somebody has gone in there and manually determined that page is going to go. And the other thing, which is really kind of creepy and interesting, is it's been reported that blogs have not just disappeared, but have actually been altered. So that's something to think about. And then in 2007, they said, even through all this, we can't keep up with it. There's going to be a renewed purification of the internet. It's affecting the development of socialist culture, and no new cyber cafes for the year 2007. So here's a cool defacement from a Chinese hacker group on a Chinese government site. Turkmenistan, the guy on the top right, the Turkmenbashi, pretty much, he was God in the country. And he said if you read his book every day, you would go to heaven. All the media was basically hymns and songs to this guy. No internet access, a couple of approved websites. And the statistics I was able to pull up basically show it very, very dead last in most of the categories for internet connectivity. This guy died at the end of last year. The new guy, he was elected on at the beginning of the year, and his one of his election promises was free access to the internet. He came into office on February 14th. February 16th, opened two cyber cafes. Western Reporter was there, said that the speed was pretty good, but nobody showed up, right? So he was essentially sitting there by himself connecting to the internet. There's one last defacement. Does anybody want to guess at the number one country on the list? North Korea. And you might recognize the little guy up on the top left. That's Kim Jong-il. And then if you look at the map, this is a satellite image of the country at night, of the peninsula at night. So you can kind of see a black space in between South Korea and China with a dot there for the capital. I imagine the internet space looks something similar. One of the things about North Korea is it reminds you a little about the novel, is that how all the houses, all the domiciles are wired, and the government has a radio feed going into the government to tell the people current events. World's most isolated country. So the perceived threat from the internet is massive. Now, in a country where, you know, like the guy's father, Kim Il-sung, in his biography, he says, you know, his first round of golf he ever played, 18 holes, he hit like 15 holes in one, right? In a country like that, you know, you can imagine that the threat from open access to the information is really just unthinkable. Still, the guy appears to be fascinated with IT. Near 2000, Madeleine Albright visited, gave her his personal email address. The chief of the military intelligence in South Korea said that some top graduates from the Kim Il-sung Military Academy have gone into an elite state-sponsored hacker unit, with the targets being South Korea, Japan, and the United States. Here's the building through which all internet traffic goes in and out of North Korea. It's said that a few firms in North Korea with needed R&D information get some information through it. There's one school where you can learn about computers and programming in the country, and they had invited Western reporters there. They take 100 male students a year, and they study English and programming. However, there's no access to the internet. So just talk a little bit about the future. I just have a few slides left and just kind of look toward the future, and only a few minutes left as well. I think national security perceptions above all. That's, you know, government, that's the, when it gets up in the morning, that's the first thing it thinks about. And second is making money. And these are related to each other very closely. So market forces and national security perceptions. To a certain extent, you'll see some countries, and I don't want to just focus on these countries, but you'll see countries in quid pro quo agreements, you know, I give you an internet surveillance system, you vote for my skaters in the next Olympics. You know, that kind of stuff is done. Actually, I don't know if you heard of that a couple years ago, but there's a big scandal in France and Russia were voting for each other's, skaters, right? So government objectives, I think there's some realistic and unrealistic goals. I think probably you could restrict, you know, wholesale, blatant attacks by the average user. But when people are willing to take a personal risk, and they're clever, and they're helped by other people, I think you'll find that it'd be very difficult in cyberspace for governments to stay on top of this. And I think we've seen that definitely, in Iran, in China, in Belarus. And so in some of these countries, you're going to have to be super draconian, like in Cuba, you know, in Myanmar and North Korea, and just say, you don't get a computer. You know, you're not going to have a computer. You're not going to connect to the internet. That's the only way you're going to prevent sort of the unrealistic goals of stopping clever users from sophisticated attacks. And one of the reasons governments have a hard time staying on top is because computer network defense is very difficult. It's hard to overstate, I think, the challenges in doing this well. And then website content, of course, is too dynamic, and, you know, software just is changing every day. And of course, you get a patch, it's changed, it's done. You can't trust it. Where's your basis for trust anymore once you've downloaded one patch onto code that you had tried to verify previously? Some of it is economics. I think, you know, as a despot or even a leader of a liberal market representative democracy, you have choices to make, and they're power or progress, right? And everybody knows that monopoly is going to hurt efficiency, and it's going to hurt competition within your country, and thus probably the vitality. And the internet is the perfect example of something that thrives on the exchange of information and sort of the comparison of good information with bad information, right? It's always helpful to look at things objectively and say, wow, you know, I've been smoking crack for the last 5 years. Now I read a study that says that's just a great idea for my health. You know, it's always healthy to try and be objective and to weigh information against other arguments. And the internet is the best example of that. One interesting article Francis Fukuyama wrote in 89 or 90, an article essentially said history ended, I think it was in 1812 or 1814, the first big Napoleonic victory. He said, since then, we've known pretty much that some type of free economy, some type of representative democracy is the best way to move forward. And since then, he's argued that since that battle, it has basically been growing in fits and starts. And I don't want to overstate the comparison here, but I think there are some. And just in terms of moving a country forward, some choices need to be made by leaders. Future of cyber resistance, I think privacy advocates should be somewhat optimistic. I think the internet probably has done more for freedom of expression, the growth of knowledge and understanding than any technology in history. Really, if you compare it to traditional media, you know, whenever there was a coup d'etat back in the day, the first thing that the coup plotters would need to do at 5 in the morning is take the national radio station and the national television station. So that, you know, later in the day, the first image you see is of the new leader. That's really not possible anymore with the internet, you know, unless you are on top of everything that's coming into your country. It's much more difficult. And the internet has done so much, I think, both for activists and ordinary people. These are some of the common tools. Again, you know, you can just look in Saudi Arabia and see that everybody's going to buy a satellite. They say, I'm not going to go through the system. I'm just going to buy a satellite and I'll connect to a Turkish or an Egyptian service provider. You know, and it'll be completely outside the system, and that's very common. You know, covert channels, essentially, I mean, they can be anything you want to pass information back and forth. And if you allow the internet in your country and you allow some exchange of information between, you know, your people and outside, you're going to lose control, per se. But the thing is, I'd just like to emphasize on this slide, is creativity and evolution. So just, you know, one of the reasons that's important is because once the government finds out how you're communicating with the NGO outside your country, of course they're going to block it. And of course they're going to come arrest you, you know. So they know your tactic. They know that software, and they can see it, and they can key in on it. So that's why, I mean, it constantly has to be evolving, and you have to use imagination and creativity moving forward. Here's just one tool in the news, but at the University of Toronto, they have a cool tool called Siphon that's especially written for countries just like we talked in the presentation. So essentially you could go home and download this tool and offer the connection information to anybody, say in China or wherever else, and they'll connect through your computer, encrypted connection, out to the World Wide Web and have free access, theoretically, to the wonders of the internet. And at that point, if it works the way the designers have intended, of course, then the security relies just on the personal trust, and the government would have to somehow perceive a problem outside the normal internet traffic that it would rely on if it had a better signature. So there's no perfect attack and no perfect defense, but again, that means there's no magic bullet for any of us, for the government or for the regular folks. So cyberspace is anarchic, but that's probably a good thing moving forward. And just a small bit of advice is just to keep a more vigilant look on things when things get dicey, when things are critical. You know, you see in Belarus with the elections, with the national referenda and stuff like that, funny things always happen. They can't connect to the internet. It's really pretty crude on the part of the government, but again, it's indicative, and you'll see that things in cyberspace tend to relate pretty closely with events in real life. In the Middle East, every time there's an uptick in violence, you see web defacements go like crazy, and so there's a pretty direct relationship. Last thing is if personally targeted, I think, you know, you should look up this thing on the internet called the Moscow Rules. And I've got to finish the presentation, otherwise, I won't have enough time here. But truth in cyberspace requires a whole lot, and this is really only available to Big Brother, usually. As a little guy, you're not going to have all these things in order to create sort of evidentiary proof of an attack in cyberspace. The human factor, that's you, and that's what this is all for, to make sure the internet is not in and of itself the goal or the important issue. Let's make it work for us instead of against us. Here is show you one more. And again, this clip is again at the beginning of the movie, so I'm not going to give anything away from the movie.
I forged government announcements and falsified figures quoted for agricultural and industrial. As a result of mental disturbance dating from my experiences during the atomic wars, I was a willing subject of Goldstein's influence. I was stubborn and egocentric. When own life thoughts occurred to me, I reveled in them. I went into the proletarian zones. I had sex with prostitutes. I deliberately contracted syphilis. It was at this time that I made contact with the resistance. I was personally contacted by the arch-traitor Goldstein and ordered to assassinate certain inner party officials. This I did. My agents forged documents and gained entry to the Ministry of Truth.
Thought crime is death. Thought crime does not entail death.
I deliberately passed.
Thought crime is death.
But the result,
I have committed, even before setting pen to paper, the essential crime that contains all others in itself.
I spent many hours of my free time encouraging my agents to deface party posters and hoarding announcements. I read and memorized Goldstein's book. For 30 years, I have plotted to bring down the party. I was sick in mind and body. Together with my colleagues, Aaronson and Rutherford, I did counterfeit the important party documents, including the ex-London permits and travel passes, and that by use of these documents, my agents traveled freely throughout Airstrip 1, encouraging insurrection and organizing a massive counterplot to destroy the inmost faction of the Oceanian leadership. I used my position of privilege within the inner party to pervert and betray the truth at all times, and to suggest wherever possible that our traditional allies in the station were in fact
dead. April 4th, 1984.
So you'll see he found the one place and the one technology that he could sit and circumvent government control and authority. So I'll just suggest to you that looking toward the future, I think it falls to all of us to play some type of role in making sure that the good and evil in cyberspace, that war is fought correctly and well, and I think each one of us individually can play a part. So anyway, thanks for coming. I really appreciate it. And any questions you have, you can either email me or chat with me later. I'll be around. Thanks.
Sure.
Let's see. I've been to. I've been to Zimbabwe. That's a good question. Let's see. Oh, he asked how many of these countries had I been to myself. Oh, here's the bibliography of sources. I have been to Zimbabwe. I have been to. And 1, 2, 3. I think that's the only country that I've been to about 50 countries or so. And I've been throughout Eastern Europe. I've been through lots of Africa and the Middle East. I could have certainly picked other countries I have been to that are low performers in terms of human rights. So, I've been in most of Eastern Europe. I've been from Egypt down to South Africa. And I've been around the Middle East, places like Syria. So, please, can you follow up?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's curious about how much this ties to my own personal experience. I've only been to Zimbabwe on the list, which I really developed sort of a soft place in my heart for while I was there. Let's see. I mean, some of the countries, like I've been to Ethiopia, I've been to, you know, Kenya, I've been to Tanzania, this is close. Unfortunately, I haven't traveled much in Asia. Some of the countries are Asian. I haven't been to Belarus, but I've been to Poland, Estonia, Russia, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia. So I've been around. I've been to like 50 countries. I spent about 4 years backpacking, studied, worked overseas. I'm out.
You're done.
I'm so sorry. Yes, question. Apologies.
No. Here's the thing. There's a Q&A room, so you can ask more questions.